But she didn't go to the play.
Oh, not by choice.
Program notes, please.
Not by choice.
Program notes, yeah, just give a summary of it.
It was showing the doubts of a Roman Catholic priest set in Chicago, whatever time, no particular era.
Yeah, right.
And his feelings about his life and his misgivings and doubts and everything else. And his relationship with a nun, and not an agape type relationship, not sexual or anything. But I guess it represented, did you mean it represented his, how he felt about women in general? And that's basically what it was all about.
The struggle with his father.
Struggle with his father and the...
Which affected his heavenly father's
relationship. Right, yeah. And he's got a terminal illness, very serious illness. So this brings all that stuff to the surface. So if he confesses in the play that he really has been a kind of closet atheist. He stopped believing, but he kept on priesting. And I don't know how common that is, except I could say as a pastor for 41 years, you go through valleys. And if you don't, how can you talk to people who are in the valley themselves? So I haven't had devastating doubt where I got wiped out and felt I couldn't have been able to say, but I've sure had my struggles and still do. And if I didn't, I don't know how I could relate to anybody in their struggles. But he just had an extra hard, long, prolonged desert experience where God didn't seem to be mattering in the world he served. It didn't seem to make any difference. People didn't get well or, critique his religion. Well, why don't we start? Angie's here. And she will.
In person.
In person. Barbara Hermanson, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us what Angie meant to you.
Well, when I first read the play, Angie meant something very personal, because I could identify with her. I'm sure a lot of women could in the story itself if you saw it last night. But otherwise, what I saw Angie as was a catalyst. I saw her as someone who kept bringing out the devil's advocate or the other side of it to him, and eventually that always seems to hopefully sink in, which it did for him. And I could identify because of the pain that he was in. Tremendously. One of my dearest friends, in fact, a fellow that I'm dating very much now and very serious about, has had exactly the same experience. And he, last I saw him, he was calling his father, and we were having similar things like this. And so it was so personal when I saw it and read it, I thought, yes, I will do this part because I want to tell that story. And I want everybody, you know, there's many, many people who've had that kind of personal thing in their life. But not only that, it's the struggle of the priest, and the struggle of you and me and everybody else about who God really is to you and who he should be. And the part that we're all as equal, one with the other, that we're all created that equal part. And what happens with the church as a system, you know, and versus what has really, what's meant by all that. You can get really bogged down in that, I think. And I like to keep it very, very simple. It's just a very simple thing, and it comes back to when he said, you know, what was it about, what kind of a person would even do this? And I said, a suffering, you know, it was Jesus. How about a man like Jesus, you know? And that was really part of it. Another part that I remembered extremely well was the part where he said, there is strength in your weakness. And I love that part, especially because it means a lot to me. Because I feel more weak than strong most of the time. So that was a personal thing, too. But I just think that Angie was a really neat person because she still was feisty. She was me. And she was fighting for her identity, herself, and for women in general, but also for where we all fit into the picture of the whole church as a system, as a whole large church. And the other part of it is that it was nice to be Catholic nun for a change. That was kind of different. And I could identify with her because I lived in the Chicago area for a long time. And I know that area and the people, the Irish Catholics, the whole thing. And I love the way they think. It's amazing how different they are from us in their childhood upbringing, though, than we are. And that comes out a lot. You can really see that, I think, because ours has a different whole setup to it as far as I could see. At least it was for me. And I feel very, very fortunate that I was brought up in that kind of a home, a loving, nurturing home. So I didn't know that pain. But I said to Michael, you know, how much of this pain have you really suffered? He said, well, I've had it really, you know, hell. You know, I didn't have that with my father. But you have to realize what pain he was in. He really was. And so that was good. I just liked it. I just thought it was a great story. And I loved playing it. It was fun to do.
Were you a Cubs fan in Chicago?
Oh, yes. I have a Bear shirt. I almost wore that today.
What about the Hawks?
Well, yeah. But, you know, if you're a diehard Cub fan, if you are, you're going to always be. I haven't lived in Chicago for 10 years. I moved to Arizona. And so, you know, I'm still a Cubby fan. I mean, all the way. So anyway, I enjoyed doing it, and I hope you do too.
Are you a professional actress?
No.
Or this is something you do for a hobby?
I haven't acted for maybe 20 years. I used to be on the stage some. But a long, long time ago. I have a daughter that's a professional actress. And parents that were.
Do you realize how long those people had to read that play and practice it?
One day.
They got the play, what is it, Monday?
We got it Sunday afternoon.
Oh, Sunday or Monday?
Yeah, Sunday.
Sunday.
Sunday afternoon we came in here and kind of talked it over a little bit and we talked it through, but that's all we did. Mm-hmm. And then yesterday we did it through once, so we went through it twice, period. Mm-hmm. So we did fairly well. But
quick studies, huh?
Well, it was a good story. It was easy to play, though, you know. You could identify.
I'm sorry that I didn't see, but I'm a little bit in the dark about what was his feeling about women. What was the priest feeling about women?
His feeling about us was, you know, okay, you're there. I was the teacher. He was also the head of the school, plus being the priest. They were good friends, so he didn't really put Angie down all that much. But his feeling was definitely, you know, that this is your role in the church and this is my role.
I see.
And you had this definite, there was a definite difference. And she was just saying, you know, that, hey, you know, when the ship is going down, the Titanic, if you remember, you know, and she's saying, hey, you know, what you're doing is standing at the front deck and saying, no women allowed, you know. You know, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And all the men, it's the man's job. It's the man's job. So it was all the way through that.
She was saying the church was dying, Catholic church, because the clergy are aging and the young people.
That's right. And I said, there are too many of you left.
And they will not accept women. Uh-huh. They're going to feed the Titanic going down.
The Detroit diocese has just closed dozens of inner city churches. I think it's happened all over the country. Of course, we closed a lot of our churches 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But they've just been closing them by. And then they've got enough people. And they could have kept them going. They're paid for and so forth. Simply don't have the clergy to man, in quotation marks, those churches.
And that's bad for an inner city, too, because when the church closes down, some of
the
congregation will move elsewhere, and then it deteriorates.
You know, it's like a doctor moving away because there are too many sick people around.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a question for me?
No, I hold my head down.
You go to an auction and do that, and I understand from people who you'll buy a big steer before you.
There were some strong statements in there. I'm sure that even there were some strong statements in there, but there you have to remember if you get inside this guy's guts, he was hurting, and that's what you have to feel is what he's going through to get to where he's going to go, and that's what I thought was part of it. He has to go through that before he can get to the other side.
We did not get to finish. See in the very end of it, due to the time, we got so
that was fun.
So we didn't see the end. So it kind of like didn't know what happened in the end.
Well, he left when his father had died. He had that message.
The roles reversed then, and I became the priest. And he got down on his knees and made his confession to me, and asked me to give him absolution, which I did. And he was very humble at that point. But the part was that I became the priest and he became the other one. Mm-hmm. And that was the significance of all that.
We try to make it symbolic that his whole attitude toward God had changed. And God was no longer this super father that he had to compare to his own father, and he was in trouble. And God became much more inclusive for him and also a vulnerable God. And a God you can even talk about. I wondered what you... Well, you finish and I'll ask more questions.
Well, I don't have anything more to say, and if they don't have questions, do you?
I just have a comment for Angie that I just thought the characters, the way they disagreed, I mean, but yet they still respected each other as people, was just a really good model, because I have struggled talking to people that are that opposed to where I'm at on these issues, and it was just beautiful.
Well, they had come from a long relationship, of course, of working together and stuff, but the part was that she could do that to him, and she was that good of a friend that he would accept that from her, where he might not have everywhere else.
And, you know, if people could read in anything of a romantic undertow if they wanted, that's fine, I think that. But it wasn't that. And it kind of showed that whatever you think about that, and that's what people think of first, they were friends. It was a good, to me, a way of stating people can be friends, and a sexual preference can not be the main ingredient of that friendship. You know, there's other things in life.
I don't think, at least on my part, I didn't get that at all, that there was a sexual...
No,
I
didn't.
Yeah, yeah. No,
good, good. Well, it wasn't supposed to be there, and that's fine.
It's kind of hard not to with that guy.
You wouldn't have gotten anywhere with that guy.
Do you have to remember, I didn't know that he was a Lutheran pastor himself, you know, and then he got up there with the white robes, I said, whoa, he really is. He was just another person, but it was interesting.
His wife didn't, by the way... In real life, you want to talk about that?
Oh, that was fun. Afterwards, she says, I saw another side of you I'd never seen before. She didn't ever see him do that before. And it was fun for her to see that. And she just thought it was kind of interesting that he had that part of him.
Excuse me.
Go on.
He just knocked her out of her socks. His wife, I don't know. They've been married, looked like their ages, maybe 15 years or 10 years or whatever.
No, they wanted to marry 6 years.
6 years. Well, you can still, that's a lot of time.
Except her parents.
There they are.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, it was great fun, and I just loved doing it. I thought it was good because it's always fun. You sort of feel like everyone does. The instrument, you know, the catalyst that you can be to trigger the feelings and the thoughts, and that's really what I wanted to be.
I was amazed at how strong she was, and the things that she, her background, she was as strong a character and as intellectual and had the resources that he did.
Oh yeah, and she was definitely his match.
Oh yeah.
In some ways I felt, and she spoke to me, and that's what characters do to you, that she was more liberated, and that she had insights into God. She was free of that stereotype God in a box, you know. She was a freer woman, and she was the catalyst, as you've been saying.
Well, and I think that's the way I feel about it, too. And I think I came up with a Haugianer, if anybody knows the old Haugianer Lutheran background, the old Norwegian background, and it was kind of, pretty strict in the bottom line there in the beginning. And so I've come a long way myself, I think, from that. And that's why I feel it, you know, so strongly. And yet the search, the deep spiritual search never stops. I mean, you don't get to a final spot ever.
But wasn't one of your favorite lines that you said you can go through years of therapy or you can tell me no?
That's right. That's right. Did you get your call?
That's Eva.
I just...
And he could fire his shrink, but he couldn't fire me.
Yeah.
It was fun. I loved it.
What other lines that you said were most spoke to you the most? Did you think were, because you know it went by so fast for us. I don't know that, you know, I don't think unless you read the play and study it beforehand, you hear everything.
Well, I think about the church, like she said, the fact that the church in general, you know, where is it going? And in 100 years, it's been there for all that time, and you know, the gates of hell are never going to prevail against it, that part. The fact of where the church is and where it's going, that meant a lot to me, as far as the general part of it. The words that meant, that I identify with is, like I said, the strength and weakness, which I think is so important for all of us to remember. Because this macho stuff is just not going to cut it, not with people, it was intelligent, you know, it just doesn't work. So that, and then also the suffering Jesus, you know, bring it back to Jesus, you know. God's, there is still this God and Jesus thing, too. And so I just think that's my bottom line, my super bottom line. It's a personal, personal thing. But that's what I come back to always in that part. The other lines that I love, oh, I can't, I'm trying to think now of some of my favorite ones, but we had some good rapport. I'm thinking, you might have remembered some more than I did, but it just went so fast that I'm saying, whoa, what did we say?
Yeah.
I may read it again.
Well, just you had a lot to think about when you were up there.
Yeah, but it was kind of funny because the one time when we came in the one scene, I said, you're supposed to be sleeping, and it wasn't his sleeping scene, it was the one before, and we pulled out of that so fast nobody ever knew it. But he was, the second scene was he was sleeping, and I came in and touched him, and he was not, you know, I thought I was not sure he was still alive at first.
Yeah, huh?
Did you catch that?
Yeah.
Yeah, we saw that.
Yeah, because I was scared.
Yeah. You know, so he came to take his pulse, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I did that on my own. I just kind of ad-libbed it because I felt it. And that's the part about it. You just put yourself in that place and say, hey, this can be, you know, we're all in and out of hospitals all the time.
Sure.
And how many times have you gone through people like that who have been in that spot and don't want to admit it and don't want to deal with it forever, you know? You're not going to. And when you come out of it, I'm back to it and forget it then. He did that too.
Yeah.
You remember how he came back and said, oh, no, I'm not showing never here again. Until whammo. So, but that was about the Lutheran pastor being bone marrow was pretty good. I thought, especially when I wasn't going to ever remind him about his female bone marrow. You know. I love the teasing. That's just the teasing part of it. But the teasing was there, you know, between us. And that was fun too. Because we could feel that. But then when it got serious, it got serious. So I love the reversal, the role that he tried, what he really had in mind in the general was the fact that we can become each other, you know, in one way or the other. I like that.
Christ to each other.
Yes. Thing about her role, she wasn't a codependent type of caretaker person.
No.
She just was herself and would not, well, I'll take care of you, I'll make sure that your father talks to you. I'll get to him, I'll do all these things.
Mm-hmm. No. And I just said, you know, you're not going to listen to me anyway, you're just too macho.
Yeah.
And especially, we should, you know, we're just like we're married, you know. So I give up on you, walk off. Well, isn't that what you do? You just say, okay, I'll walk out of there for a while, let him do it. And that's when he went into that major thing of his then, at that point where he really had to talk to God. I got to go to work, God. I mean, I got to go to work, folks. And do the laundry.
Thank you. Do you have a question you want to ask her?
A question, just a comment. I was raised Catholic, and went through grade school with nuns, and I couldn't help but contrast and compare the situation today that you're in and the nuns of
20 years ago.
That's being kind, yeah. And the freedom that they have now.
Oh, yeah.
And that which they didn't have in the 50s. And it's really a global thing that has happened for the nuns in the Catholic Church. And even though this is perhaps fiction, it's
pretty real.
Close to life.
It's pretty real, I thought. And that was why I didn't know quite how to be, you know, whether I want, you know, I wanted to be that part, and yet I wanted to be liberated in that. I didn't want to be the old one.
Somebody said you were a little too sexy for a nun.
I'm sorry.
That's a stereotype, see?
It says she's, you know, he described me in the thing, so I did what he said.
That's right. Thanks a lot. Thanks again. You might be interested. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to mention, this is not only true, of course, with the Catholic Church, this is true in the Lutheran tradition too. I mean, 40 years ago, we were listeners and receivers, and maybe youth directors or whatever it was. But there was very little to be said what comes down from the pulpit.
Well, if you want to know something about that, she said, it was interesting to see that, I don't know whether she just, reference I got was that, this happened in the Catholic background, but not in ours. Everything there, I took some things from my knowledge of nuns and priests, But everything that happened, the can of Charlie, the father thing, the doubts, the confession at the end where she is hearing his, that had to be kind of Roman Catholic. We don't quite do it that way in church. That's why I wanted to take something farther out for us, and then we can make our own application. But everything really, 90% of that play, it's not from the Roman Catholics.
Sure.
It's the Lutherans. It all happened in my experiences in the Lutheran church as a boy growing up in a home. And, so it's there is a lot more in common than there is in distinction.
Did you write the play?
Yeah. Still writing it. We're going to do it some places this fall, and that's why it's so helpful to get some reactions. In fact, I'd like to get more of your reactions, and then you want to ask me questions of the origin of it or how we type these characters. I can give you whatever. And we'll do a little more of this on Saturday if you're around on drama in the church. And that's a thing that's forcing me to come to grips with how you develop and how it could be applied in the church, what I think about the future of drama in the church. I think that's where we should put a lot of emphasis in our teaching, and people can learn a lot. Yes?
In watching it, in growing up in the Lutheran church too, I think my biggest fear was that those people who were teaching us from the pulpit and preaching didn't really believe either. You know, it's such a difficult thing when you think and, you know, you look at the stars and you wonder where your point is, and you're at camp and everybody seems to be believing just fine, and you're just kind of wondering how this fits in, you know, for you. And then you suspect that they don't really believe. And here he is saying this. It just kind of taps into the biggest fear I think people have.
Now, what did that do to you when you saw him expressing his doubts? Did that make you cynical?
I've had cynical experience since then, so I'm not afraid of that anymore. Okay. But I certainly have been a lot during my life. I don't have any doubt about, you know, Jesus being my Savior anymore. But my goodness, yes. That's a really... And then when he said, God damn God, I thought you had written it. I thought that must have been very painful to write that, to dare to say that.
Yeah. It took
to
a
dare
long
to let him say that.
Yeah. Or to say it myself. Or, yet how could you say, well, you, what was the rest of your reaction to that curse? Were anybody put off by it? Say so.
I think, you know, because our society, I think at times has become too lenient with it, but it has been somewhat of a freeing way of being able to swear and not feel that you are condemned because you've used that. But I found the humor, as far as my own reaction to it, I found the humor to be very, it's kind of a path into what you were talking about. You know, the humor was good in the sense that it allows you to be open and receiving the other parts of it. So for me, the humor was good.
When you think about it, it's a kind of impossibility, isn't it? God damn God. How's God going to damn God's self? You know, it was meant to be a little ludicrous. In that sense, you got to believe in God a whole lot to ask God to damn God's self. I mean, that's a real.
Yeah.
I mean, I think God can appreciate a full-hearted curse a lot better than a half-hearted praise.
Oh.
And then you have to ask, what is the relationship between a curse and a prayer?
It is.
And kill the person who cares enough about God to get angry. You know, the Old Testament is much better at this than we are. Get mad at God, you know, shake. Job almost got to the point of cursing God. Remember his wife said to him, curse God and die? And he couldn't quite do that. I'm afraid you're going to die, I'm afraid of the righteousness of God. And Job was a very conventional Lutheran, and he was not going to be caught saying that and maybe go to hell. And, you know, so an everlasting meeting of sin and hell.
Until you talked earlier in the week about that you could do that and express that to God, It never occurred to me that you could do that to God.
Well, I don't suggest this as a new part of the liturgy.
No, but I mean, it's accurate. People do feel that despair. And if you're going to confess how you feel to God, maybe you need to really tell God how you feel.
You know, think about it in terms of human relations. Who is it that you get the maddest at? Is it the stranger, the clerk that's rude to you? You get a little, and we learn most of it because that happens quite a bit. We learn to kind of shuck and jive and let that roll off if we're at all going to stay sane in this society. But the person that we live with, the person that's closest, our husband or wife or our kids, ourselves, man, we can get really worked up. And you know the old song, you always hurt the one you love? Of course. Well, they're closest. And you can hurt them easier than you can the stranger, and you will hurt them more because you care about them. Now, if we were to care most about God, and we're finally going through this life being wooed by God, so that finally someday we will know what it is to really care about God, then shouldn't we, as we do with our closest person on earth, have the opportunity to get angry with God? My son is going through I'll tell you just an illustration. He's 43 years old, he's an editor and reporter in a big paper, and doing very well. Got four lovely kids. They sort of skipped their back in my generation, they've forgotten that. But anyway, I don't know which one of those kids they should have stopped. I mean, they're wonderful, they can take care of them. They're great parents. And Scott works a night shift, so he can be home, so Sarah can do a lot of volunteer stuff in the community, gets paid for some of it. Anyway, he's got a bad mole on his nose, pray for this. And we're worried because it could develop into a cancerous thing, and it started to bleed, and it's grown on. And so we're after him. All my counseling skills, everything goes out the window. I don't know how to handle it. I just tell him, Scott, get to the doctor. He's moving now. He's too busy. He's afraid. And he got mad at me the other night. Hung up. He never did that. He got madder at me than he ever did as a kid, as a teenager. Never got mad at that. Maybe he should have. And he called back the next day and apologized. He said, Dad, you've got to understand, when you push that hard, you're going to get a reaction. And I just had to get mad at you. Thank God he could. I could never get mad at my father. See, my father's one that said, you're an eagle shit. I could not get mad at my father. Wow, he really does love me. You get mad at me. He said, God damn it, Dad, lay off. You got to have some trust to be able to say that to somebody and know they're not going to be ticked off at you and kiss you off and say, anyway, that was my story. If you think of how he did it, get his butt to the doctor. I'd love to have you tell me. Hey. Pray for him. He's got to get there.
Pay him.
Pay him to go. No, he won't go that way. He'll go when he's good and ready. Yeah. I don't know. He's a stubborn
talk
guy.
Talk to his wife. Have her intercede for you.
Oh, no, she can't do it. And she learns how to play him a little at a distance. He'll go, but it's tough. But anyway, it's just personal. But the point is, we get mad, and we say things, and hopefully we apologize, and we don't say things that are abusive. I make a distinction between getting mad, getting angry, which is legitimate, just as joy, laughter, crying, are all healthy emotions. I make a distinction between that and emotional abuse of a child. So abuse of a child is what happened to Michael. His father was constantly degrading him, see. The kid would just rise up like a little tender shoot, wham, the father would come down on him. And just he's going to become an Eagle Scout, he's an Eagle Ship. That's abuse, see. That is destroying somebody's self-esteem. That you don't do. Now you get mad at somebody. My son was not destroying my self-esteem. Nor I his, although he might have thought I was in the treatment room. that way. He said, I'm 43 years old, you're 3 minutes, and I bit my tongue, thank God I didn't say it, but stop acting like a 3-year-old. I didn't. Anyway, that's a difference between anger, even saying something you're sorry for, and abuse. Abuse is a constant pattern of degrading somebody, sexually, physically, emotionally. And we've got to make a distinction. And that's, see, Michael had been abused as a kid. That's why he had a hard time relating to God. And he had this father God. He had to deal with it. Every time he heard the word father, thought of father, he thought of this father that destroyed him, or tried to. Remember, he said he didn't want to get married, one of the reasons, because he was afraid to have children and pass due to his children what his father had done to him. And unfortunately, that pattern, I think, by the grace of God, you can break it. You know, like Harry Truman said, the buck stops here. You can say, I'll make my own mistakes. Whatever I do, I will not do the same thing my father did to me. And you can mean it. And I probably abused my kids in being too busy doing something else. I thought it was saving the world and not paying enough attention to them at critical points. But I didn't abuse my kids like my father did me. I did not do that. I did not do it in a destructive way. I did it in a stupid, selfish, ignorant, insensitive, but not boom, boom, get them down. That's what Michael went through, and he turned it in a healthy way to the church, looking for a father. Freud is right. We turn to God as a father substitute. I think that's right. Partially right. Like a lot of groups, they're half true. The point was Freud could not deal with, because Freud, you know, he had his blinders. And he's been revised a lot. Jung and others have since then. But he did not understand theology or God. And he did not carry it to the next logical step, which is, yes, God can be a father substitute for some. And a good one, really. You know, what better father to have, or mother to have. But he didn't carry it to the other one, that father or mother or sister or brother, as Jesus said, can become a God substitute. Ah, see? If you absolutize someone and you say, I'm going to get my meaning, my inner strength, my joy, that person has got to feed me in a marriage. I depend on that person. I don't know how I live without them, on and on and on. Or I glorify somebody, and then they let me down. Well, so what's new? Everybody lets everybody down. That's what it is to be human. But we set that person up for a fall. And so Michael stopped with that. He didn't pick out any priest and put him on a pedestal. He just stopped believing in people and his father. Then he stopped believing in God because he saw not much caring from God, just as he didn't experience caring from his father. And he had to get a whole new other idea of God in order to come back to his father, and they kind of went around. He got a new insight about his father, Angie pushing him. It's too much work getting up every morning hating your father. That's just too much work. Can't carry that. And so he got a new idea about his father, and then he gets a new idea about God. God's not this macho God, the super father. Fix it, you know, everything's going to be okay. God is struggling, God is vulnerable, God is evolving. Don't you like that idea of a struggling, evolving God? Doesn't have it all made. Did that shake you up? You can handle that all right? Well, then you're with...
How do I handle it? I have kind of funny feelings. I once read that a Jesuit priest, I can't remember the name, but some very famous theologian, said that he thought Jesus Christ came from another planet and so on. And I think, well, maybe that makes sense. You know, maybe that's where we go. This is heaven.
Well, it's a good symbolic thing. He was not of this world in the sense that, hey, you don't find it. such a weird dude walking around every day. I mean, this guy is really different, you know. And I mean, weird in a very blessed sense. Weird meaning not the, your average human being. I mean, this guy is so unique that we call him God.
But what do you mean? What do you mean by evolving?
That's what I was throwing out. I'm evolving in my evolving idea. But there's a notion of God, and it's called, in technical terms, process theology. But it's the idea that God is not static. God is not this super father. I think some of us can get by that. Or mother. And that God has got it all made, and it's up to us to just kind of catch on to what God's doing, and God is all powerful and all. What if God, for reasons that only God knows, either is not all powerful or has made a kind of a bargain with himself or herself and the world, or God is operating with one hand tied behind your back? I don't know. It's the idea that if you have an all-powerful God, then why do you have a kind of evil? Why do little children get picked up on the streets and tortured in Brazil and so forth? Why all this? And if you have a limited God, then what good is that? So the battle is, but the God is actually down struggling with us like Jesus did. The God did not just die on the cross in Calvary 2,000 years ago, but God dies on every cross that we bear. God feels our pain. God is evolving in the sense of leading us, but from down below rather than from top down. I'm still thinking about this.
I really dislike.
You like? Don't like?
I don't like the word God.
You don't like what?
I don't like that terminology. Of a God that's evolved.
Oh, okay. What the rest of you think?
I look upon it in a different way. If we're all unique, and I think indeed we are, we have similarities, but we also, you know, are separate identities. I think that God created all of us, and he's getting to know us and change with us, too, as we go. So that does not, I do not like the idea of a rigid, punitive, totally controlling God. I like to feel we have some free choice and things, and I like to feel that maybe he likes to look and enjoy children. Maybe sometimes when we're doing bad things, jumping into the mud and the puddle and stuff like that, as it were, when we're in sin. And, you know, maybe he thinks, oh, that's naughty. It's kind of cute, maybe, but it is naughty. It's not right, you know. But I think that he likes to see the uniqueness in each of us. Therefore, he has to be a little flexible, a lot flexible. That it's not all rigid, all up there. I don't like that.
Yeah.
Why? Oh,
you
I agree with that.
Yeah.
See,
what do you
have told? Evolving to me says that God has yet to reach his ultimate. See, evolve means to gradually achieve a goal.
Right.
See, I don't.
They have trouble with that.
God,
I agree with you. I have trouble with it too. But
see, I like the idea that in the Old Testament he can deal with people in anger, you know, and to a situation react, and to the other situation, you know, compliment and encourage, just as Christ did.
You don't have any problem with that?
Oh,
God's
no.
Emotional.
I don't like a lot of the Old Testament severe reaction. But on the other hand,
what do you do with the Old Testament, though, and you know, we common scripture here? But God, and the references to God repented. You know, when he's going to destroy the city, and then God repents.
Oh, you know, if you didn't believe that God at least changes his mind or has a different perspective, why pray? You know, we ask constantly, Lord, you know, for this, and we believe in the answers to prayers, not always our answers, but there's prayers that are answered, and I believe firmly that if you pray believing, you will receive, but, you know.
Sometimes it comes in different forms.
I think he's like a great conductor when we're in the orchestra, and he's there conducting, and we're asking him to place the baton directed towards us occasionally. And I have a weird feeling about prayer. I'm a former Catholic, incidentally, Irish Catholic, which makes me the fiercest kind.
How long were you Catholic?
for, well, until I was 21, I was very devout, and then I married someone who would not let me go to any church.
Now you don't go.
I stayed 22 years in that abusive marriage, and I've been single 8. I probably will be single forever, because I'll never trust another man. And so I kind of feel, I'm kind of got sidetracked here, that, oh boy, let me think about it a minute and we'll come back.
You've been a Lutheran for how many years?
For 6 years. I've been single 8.
And why did you choose
Lutheranism? Why did I choose Lutheranism? Because I kind of really wanted, the Catholic in me never died, and I'm still fiercely Catholic underneath. That's my foundation. I found that whenever I wasn't too depressed, I would pray, and they were always Catholic-type prayers and so on, and always the church, you know, saying, hang in, like Mother Teresa, you know, just, you know, this suffering, you're going to be rewarded, stick by, you've got to stick by the children, you've got to hang in there somehow, and I don't know how I did it by shutting all myself off. But when I was single, I also remembered the Irish Catholic Church that I was raised in, thou shalt not divorce. I was in a mixed marriage, incidentally, Episcopalian, nominally Episcopalian. And then I decided that, no, I could not go back. I might be very unlucky and get a good Irish Catholic priest in a parish and be told, you are a wicked woman, you have divorced. And I thought, I cannot. I struggled so hard. I tried for 10 years to get out of that marriage. Never had the courage. And when I did, I didn't want somebody to plunk me back because I didn't even know it survived coming out a second time. And so I thought I wanted something close to Catholicism. And to me, the closest was Lutheranism, so that's why. And it is very close. And I'm very Catholic, too, you know, I mean, it's just, it's
there. Did you feel any twinges of that we were being unfair in any way to the Catholics in the play?
No. I thought it was very real. You created a kind of an empathy in me for that man, because I have known men like that.
Yeah.
I have relatives who are like that, who, you know.
Did you feel at the end that Michael changed?
I didn't see the very final thing. I just struggled.
Those of you
who
saw the whole
tired.
Play, did Michael change for you? How did he change?
I thought he acknowledged in himself that he had to love the part of him that was weak and maybe follow Jesus more than that image of God that he had.
And the fact that he's willing to ask for her to be his confessor. Mm-hmm. That in Catholic theology is
He made her be the confessor.
He made her be the confessor.
Yeah, I thought that was really neat. He really enabled her and forced her. You know, you have to say this. That's the way I took that.
Say the rest of it, Angie.
Yeah.
I call a priest, and I said, and I know the confession of Lutheran Church is similar, but don't you guys have a shorter one than we do? And he said, yeah, sure. He read off that one. And that was two lines. I confess before my sisters and brothers and so on. And then the other part, I absolve you. Know, that to me was complete change of reversal role, which he, and it's acknowledging she was Jesus Christ to him. That was really his freedom.
Very powerful.
Well, I think his role as this high priest, he lost that role and became a priest of the people, in which he needed to do anyway, which all people in the church need to be a person for the people. And I think that was the biggest change, that he could accept the fact that he was a person first, not a priest.
Yes.
You know, the other thing that struck me is in Minneapolis, and our pastor has said to us that a number of his colleagues really were leaving the church, not as parishioners, but as leaders, because they're getting eaten up alive.
They're what?
They're getting eaten up by the congregation or by the job. And to me, part of his trouble was not only his image of his father and his relationship to God that was suffering, but also the fact that there wasn't any support for him in the church. He didn't find any comfort with, you know, his colleagues and
Michael, you
know, right?
Yeah.
Only the nun.
Right.
You know, only the one person who kind of kept him on track and forced him to look at these issues. But the church is not lifting him.
Yeah.
And I think that's really sad that the church doesn't lift the leaders of the church and help them with these struggles, because they're certainly, I think it's a big problem that we have in our society is eating up our leaders and not allowing them to be human and to get the help they need to keep going.
I think they have done that more.
Machines, the bureaucracy.
But I think they have done that more in the last 10, 15 years than they were before. I am a former minister's wife, and I was in situations where I did not feel supported by the church as an ex-pastor's wife, and was very devastated by that. But ironically, neither was my ex-husband. There was a sense he was more supported, but as a result of many of the divorces in the Lutheran church now in the parishes, they came together and decided, at least I was even in a workshop of trying to, what do you need from us as an ex-minister's wife? What does the parish need? What do they need to do to support the pastor and his family? What does the church need to do to support the pastor and the family? So they began to reach out more and provide counseling that nobody needed to know about if there was a problem. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this did not happen at the time of our divorce, and I was divorced in 1980. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this 12 years has made a big difference. But it is, they are eating up a lot.
We had a situation in our church where the youth pastor was abusing one of the kids. And, you know, of course it was a very public situation, and it was very painful. And I had a close relationship with the senior pastor at the time, and he was really hospitalized over this situation, over this betrayal, and the horror and the shame of it, and the whole situation. And he needed a lot of help, and he did get it from the church, you know, from the Lutheran church. He called it the Lutheran Mafia, came in and just took over for him and really helped him out. But we need to do that for our leaders, and I sense there wasn't much help for him. I think it's really normal to have these doubts and have these valleys, like you were talking about when Bruce and I walked in.
But I think it's important also for pastors to realize that they can be vulnerable to the people in their congregation. I was always receptive to that as a pastor's wife. I told people my fears, my doubts, my concerns. My ex-husband was much more or less capable of doing that. He always felt that he had to be perfect in every single way so that no one knew what his doubts were and his fears were. But at the same time, people respond to you much, they realize that, you know, you're no more perfect than they are. I mean, that you've got hurts and pains and difficulties and struggles just like they do. And so to me, that only creates a closer bond in that relationship, is you are able to leave yourself vulnerable and open yourself to them. So if the pastors recognize that they can be vulnerable to people, like, I don't say you have to, you know, maybe pick out. I mean, remember for a long time, and maybe you were of that particular age, that you didn't have friends in the congregation. That was a no-no.
Yeah.
You don't have friends in the congregation. Because when we came through, we decided we were going to have friends, and we did have friends.
We had very different parishes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Getting back to your hand, that's very perceptive, and I appreciate your thought. Maybe what I really need to flesh out here is a little more of the, I don't know if God changes or not. I mean, we're talking about God, and we're saying, you know, is this like a plant that starts a little seed and grows up, and all the human analogies break down. But maybe what we're really saying is that we're the ones that change. Our perception of God changes. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, Mark Twain saying how, when he was 15, he hated to be in the same room with his father because his father said such stupid things. Then when he got to be 21, he was amazed at how much the old man had learned in 6 years. And maybe that's really what we're saying. But I think what Michael was rebelling against, and what the God he did not believe in, and that's important to ask an atheist, to ask ourselves when we have right now, what God don't you believe in? And I've talked to people like that, and I'm trying to get those, and I said, if that's atheism, move over, because I'm on the bench too. And the God he didn't believe in, couldn't buy anymore, was this macho, controlling God who always was in charge, like his father, control him. And then he found out that isn't the God that, remember Angie said, he said to her, well, finally, you give her a break, the little woman, maybe she has a brain in her head. Well, what kind of God, you never told me what kind of God you believed in. She says,
you never
asked. And so when he got away from that controlling God, and maybe we should say more about Jesus in there, because that's the vulnerable God.
Yeah, that's the wonderful.
Maybe you should flesh that out a little more.
A lot more about Jesus.
Okay.
Because Jesus is the way.
All right.
I think she can bring Jesus to him even a lot more. When Ted was saying, the evolving God, it brought me back to, there's one thing I remember a lot from confirmation probably, but I memorized, God is the Spirit who is eternal, almighty, all-knowing, everywhere present, wise, good, merciful, holy, true, and just. And all the Bible verses go with that. But there isn't anything in there that says he's evolving.
Yeah.
He's, to me, that's it's like the universe is going to end with the kind of bang that it started with, if you go that way.
Yeah.
And then where's God?
Yeah, right. Yeah, you have to be careful. You don't lose God in the process of trying to not control God. We go from one extreme to the other. One extreme would be got this all-controlling God, like sort of big computer in the sky God. Then we could go to the other extreme where we got just an oblong blur, as somebody said, or just such a wimp of a God that we don't have anything to get a hold of. It's like trying to throw a ball into a bowl of jello.
But I think it is true, for me, as you say, it's not so much that God is evolving, but that God evolves within us. Mm-hmm. And it's like, biblically, you don't feed meat to the baby, you give milk to the baby, and that's how we evolve, You have to start where that particular person is.
How did you handle the line when she asked him, it's kind of a provocative way, if he could forgive God. What did that do for you? Did the idea of forgiving God ever occur? Is that blasphemy as far as we've been brought up to think? Is there a sense in which we could say that?
Not for forgiving God, but forgiving his image of God that's his father. I thought that's what she was ministering to him is, you have this all mixed up. You're looking at God as this horrible father. And I don't think any of us are ever going to forget that, the line of eagle shit. I mean, you couldn't have said that stronger. That is the most abusive thing I've ever heard anybody say. That's just horrible. Horrible.
You think it should have been left out?
No. No, I think things that people never forget are really good to keep in. But that's the horror of the relationship I think he has with God, is it somebody who could look at him like that.
Our whole relationship is based, really, to me, our relationship to God is based on our relationship to our parents. And if we have not had good relationships with our parents, for whatever reason, I think that is our perception of how we perceive God to be.
But I hope that,
on the other hand, it can be in different ways.
Yeah,
but if you don't, you're not from a very happy home, which is I wasn't to begin with, and that's why I put up with an abusive marriage. I thought men were like that. And I know now they're not all like that.
Keep thinking that way.
I thought, well, God loves me. I always thought that. God loves me. I always did.
Well, and I hope people go away shaking their head. I don't see how that kind of God, you know, like, what good is a God like that? Or revolving God, what in the world is that? I hope just that, and I hope people, you know, what is it to curse God? And is that a form of actually affirming God, loving God, caring enough about God? And is there a sense in which we have to say, I have to forgive God because God doesn't do things the way I want God to do them? That doesn't mean they should have been done. God knows they should not have been done my way. But there's an awful lot of untidiness in this world. A lot of loose ends, God. I don't understand them. Maybe you're going to tie them up someday. But in the meanwhile, I guess I got to let go of judging you. Or of my anger. And but he had to say that, just like my son had to say it to me. He had to say that in order to get to the next step when he could call Angie up and say, come and be my confessor. Anyone else have some thoughts here?
Yes, yeah. I never thought it was brought across that maybe the church was on a downhill, going away, and to me that's an abominable thought, because the Spirit, we are the church, the Spirit of God is with us, and should be with us, and will continue to be with us, yeah. Forever and ever.
Yeah. I think
that's my image of God, and
what you said. How did you take it to mean that the church as the Spirit of God on earth, as Jesus' body, was going to go down, or the form that we see it today, the Roman Catholic, no women, clergy, so forth, will have to change?
Well, that is changing. We have seen it changing over the years, yes, already in our short span. But the thousand-year church will go on and on.
Sure. A different form.
Yeah.
I hope.
Right.
Anybody else have that? Yeah.
Well, I used to have an art teacher. One of her greatest problems was telling people when to quit. You've made your statement, now stop.
Yeah.
I've seen you taking notes over there, a lot of thoughts coming out of this group.
Yeah.
But don't worry about it. You've got a good product there. You can work on it forever.
Well, I've messed around with it so many. That's about the 20th version.
And as the years go by, certain things will change.
Yeah, I thank you for that.
That's still your father coming out. I mean, that you need to continue to evolve yourself. You still believe that you're eagleship.
Yeah.
And that you need to continue to change.
God, you're good. How much you charge an hour? Just one last, or I guess, is it 20 hour? I've got 20 hour.
Yeah.
I've got 5 minutes.
You have to go.
Thank you, but you might be interested in what I'm an amateur at this, but I'm learning, and I've spent the last 5 or 6 years working on plays. I've done some screenplays. They're hard to sell because of probably the way Hollywood looks at anything with religion, and because you're unknown and so forth. So I turn to the stage now, or theater, and I think the church is a sleeping giant with theater, respect and drama, a lot of things. And I mentioned, I think, earlier that, or maybe before the play the other night, that the theater started in the church 1,000 or more years ago. And it didn't start, you know, with Shakespeare and Stratford and so forth. It started in the church. And they had morality plays, and this was before television and before people read. Now we're back to that again. How much do we read? Anyway. They did the whole thing and acted out not only the Passion of Jesus, the Christmas story, but a much more serious thing than just a little 15-minute Sunday school pageant. They went on and on with it. And they had morality plays in which they would act out the Gospels and act out the stories where people would take a message from them. But that's what the churches were done as.
When were the morality plays? What?
I've got to check, but I'd say somewhere around 1100. So that's the number that comes back. Anyway, I think And then the fact that they have big chancels, the room for the people to come in and out and so forth. I think, you know, you look at most churches, big sanctuaries or small, whatever, sit there vacant night after night. In fact, it's the most underused and unused piece of real estate in the community. And some of them are only used maybe a dozen or two dozen times a year. What do you use them for? The Advent, some places, a Christmas Eve, maybe a New Year's Eve, Lent, and a few memorial services. Now we're doing more in the evening, okay? So what do you got? In a big church, you might have 10, 15, 20 times a year. That leaves an awful lot of times left for a Sunday night drama from 7 to 8:30 with little coffee and cookies and a discussion. That sort of thing. So I'm going to try to see, test that out and see where it goes. And things have a marvelous way of falling in place. It's been a long struggle, and things seem now to be a little bit more, see roads opening up. The fact that your son-in-law is Jim. Lives in Brooklyn. Well, I was just in New York in June, and St. Peter's at 54th and Lexington. Talk about off of Broadway, that's at the edge of Broadway. They've got a little theater now, sort of one of these blackout theaters, you know, everything's black, little rows of lights, but they leased it. So we were going to do it there, but then it got leased, and the church needs the money. And they've got a long-term thing, so they can't interrupt it with just a, you know, a little thing like mine. But then John Gensel, the pastor jazz musician, said, let's do it in the sanctuary. Let's do it right here. So we were getting all set, and then they have the interim going, and the new pastor's coming next Sunday or Sunday after that, I think the 1st of September now. They didn't want to start it and then have it lapse over into the new person's pastor. So we're waiting till the new person comes. But I talked to your son-in-law. He's a subway ride. He's 45 minutes or 40 minutes from 54th and Lexington. So there's, if we could do it there, hey, we're in big time. But do it in the church where it came from. Do it with somebody like your son-in-law. And but they liked it. So we'll see what happens. I read a Catherine Hepburn is a very favorite person of mine, and she did. I read her most of her new biography, Me, but she did another book earlier called Making the African Queen. That's one of my favorite movies. And remember, John Huston was directing it, and John and Humphrey Bogart were old boozing buddies, and they just came down to their drink. They couldn't get on the set, they couldn't do anything, they didn't tell anybody, they were either drunk or out shooting elephants or both. So, and Catherine was going out of her gourd. She's very disciplined, she comes down there, she's getting sick from the water, the food, and the mosquitoes, and she's sitting around cooling her heels while this fool is out there shooting elephants, trying to. So she finally said, look, John, you got to tell me one thing, and then you go and shoot some elephants. We're going to make this movie. But you tell me who, this missionary lady, what was her name? Sister, somebody.
But she didn't say who the character was.
A wonderful contrast in characters. The old rummy, and then this very prim, proper, straight-laced missionary lady. Who is she? Tell me, give me a reference. Who is she? And finally, John says, she's Eleanor Roosevelt. Now, what the hell? And he goes off. I mean, that's all I needed. Eleanor Roosevelt. So she thought Eleanor Roosevelt, and she got the character. I thought about this as this play evolved, and I thought, first of all, and I got halfway.